It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new study shows that binge drinking costs Wisconsin nearly $4 billion a year. We'll see what makes up that price tag and what could be done to reduce problem drinking here in the state.
First, it's Food Friday, and this week we're talking about the cuisine of Croatia.
You can find a lot of surprising dishes in and around the country, but some hallmarks of Croatian cooking might be familiar to us here in Wisconsin, from hearty stews, sausages, and even homemade cheese.
Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. She's also leading a WPR travel vacation to Croatia and Slovenia next May. Lori, thanks for being here.
Dobar dan. Kako si?
You're hosting a trip to Croatia next year.
Yes.
With this food, it seems like national borders are less important than the people and the land, right?
And the fact that there are food traditions that have carried over even as borders have changed over the centuries. We're talking about Croatia, which is on the eastern side of the Adriatic Sea, but Turkey's been involved, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire has been involved. And if you've ever read Lydia Bastianich's cookbook, Lydia's Italy, her home, Istria, is now actually a part of Croatia. So it's right on the border. There's a chance for an amazing melding of cultures, and then, of course, an amazing melding of food. So as you say, there are certain things about Croatian cooking that you immediately recognize, but there are all of these interesting variations that I'm having a lot of fun with.
What are some of the key parts of Croatian food that you're running into? What kind of defines the heart of Croatian cooking?
I'm finding more and more of a reliance on fresh herbs than, say, Indian food is all about not just spices, but layering spices so you get different flavors. I'm not saying Croatian cooking is bland. There's an awful lot of paprika. Gee, Hungarian, I wonder why. And then the cookie recipe that I've fallen in love with has cinnamon and nutmeg and black pepper in the cookies. I'm not saying that the food is bland, but it tends to focus on maybe one or two stronger flavors, and they're combined in ways that I'm not exactly familiar with.
Let's talk about that recipe then, those cookies that you talked about. Paprenjaki?
Paprenjaki.
Excellent.
Yes.
They have black pepper in them. We've got the recipe up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Tell us about these cookies.
These are used in the holiday season, very much the way we would use gingerbread. You can make them so that they're a little bit firmer, and they're outlined in royal icing. I've even seen paprenjaki men with the eyes and the buttons and the whatnot. And it's butter and lard, sugar and honey, ground walnuts, lemon, and then cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, cardamom, and black pepper. It's a fairly stiff dough, but you can roll it out. It's one of those great doughs that it doesn't seem to mind if you overwork it a little. They're supposed to be a fairly firm cookie, but if you can make them a couple of days ahead of time and put them in an airtight container so they can get soft, they're wonderful. Incredibly spicy and yet sweet at the same time.
You made a batch. The reviews, I'll say, were positive, Lori. Now, you were saying the other day, I don't think it was in these cookies, but often with pastries, there's some alcohol in the dough in Croatian cooking.
Lots of alcohol in the dough. One of the pastries I'm looking forward to trying when we get there is a krostula, which is a sweet dough that's enriched with eggs and olive oil, and rakija, which is a fruit brandy that's very similar to Italian grappa. They do a lot of frittule, or what we would call a sweet fritter, where the dough would be perhaps wrapped around prunes or dates, but the prunes and the dough will have a little bit of that alcohol in it as well. There's one cake I cannot get a recipe for, but I've heard the recipe for. It's a traditional, the bride makes this the day before the wedding to maybe sweeten the groom's attitude a little bit more. And that includes liqueur that's made from rose petals. So alcohol is important. I'm not saying we're planning to go to Croatia and get completely smashed. That said, one of the great winemakers who came to California in the 60s and gave California its boost on the world stage in winemaking is Mike Gergich, one of the great Croatian winemakers, got his name really in this country.
Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. We're talking about Croatian cuisine now. And as we are drawing the line between Croatia and the United States, let's bring it right home to Wisconsin. You've seen cheese curds show up in this.
I was stunned to find dairy is really important. They have one particular pastry that's an entree. It's not meant to be sweet. They call it Strukli, but they love this cottage cheese and sour cream filled pastry so much that they've got two ways to prepare it. You can either make the pastry and then boil it or bake it. They do a lot with softer curd cheese, similar to what we would call a chev, only it's made from cow or sheep milk. And you can either serve it at the beginning of the meal, drizzled in olive oil, serve it for dessert, drizzled in honey. And yes, apparently in Croatia, they love squeaky cheese. I want to find out what a Croatian cheese curd tastes like.
And the cheese is homemade.
Very, very often you'll find a lot of really good cheeses in, from just small communities. And this is what we're bringing out. Very, very similar, it sounds like, to what we've got in our farmers markets.
And staying in Wisconsin a little bit, Lori, you are a fan of some Balkan restaurants in Wisconsin. People might see Serbian restaurants. This is across the border. Some common themes here between Serbian and Croatian cooking. What do we have access to here?
If you are in the Milwaukee area, you probably already know what I'm going to say. The Three Brothers, the restaurant in Bayview. They bill themselves as Serbian, although one of the stories I heard is that when the restaurant started in the 1950s, the Three Brothers it was named after were still in, at the time, Yugoslavia. So, again, that whole idea that the borders are a little bit fluid. Now, when I was a little kid, my parents took me there, and this was my light bulb moment, that food was more than just the fish sticks in the cafeteria, that food could be an adventure. Between the feta cheese in the salad, which suddenly made green peppers taste good to me for the first time, to that incredible phyllo pastry pie called börek, which you can have at the Three Brothers with cheese and spinach or with meat. Although if you are going to the Three Brothers, it really does let them do their best job. If you want the börek, call ahead, because it can sometimes take an hour to get that to your table. But that was my introduction to what food of, for want of a better word, the Balkan Peninsula can taste like. It's always been a favorite, and I can't recommend it enough. So if you are interested in what we're talking about today, but you don't think you're going to be able to make any of this food, if you are in the Milwaukee area, the Three Brothers is always worth the drive.
Yeah, certainly, because sometimes food that isn't familiar can be intimidating. Is there a good place to start when it comes to Croatian food that we're making at home when we don't really have the experience?
The dish that made me so happy to try in the last couple of weeks is a simple chicken and vegetables dish. It's familiar enough that you're going to recognize it, but there's just enough differences that you can tell it's not the way your mother makes it. First of all, your vegetables start with green pepper, but not sautéed. You get out a cast iron skillet or any pan that can handle high heat, and you throw in your green pepper in the hot pan with no fat. You blister the green pepper. If you've got a griddle, do it on the griddle. Then you take that green pepper out of the pan, and then you add your chicken and your onion and your mushrooms. The recipe I was given said just use button mushrooms. I ended up adding other stronger mushrooms as well. And that's when you sauté it in fat. I would normally sauté it in olive oil. Croatia says you sauté it in butter. And again, just different enough that the taste made a real impression on me. You add thyme leaves and smoked paprika. And here's the other thing. Chicken and vegetables, we usually put that on the plate with a starch on the side. In Croatia, they like eating this as a sandwich filling. They put it on a soft roll the way we put hot ham on a roll on Sunday afternoons.
I love the versatility of that. And that recipe is also up at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we are talking with WPR's Lori Skelton about Croatian cooking.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a type of food you're familiar with? Do you have any favorite recipes to share? If you've traveled to Croatia or other areas of the Balkans, what do you remember about the food? Is this part of your own family's food heritage? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. We continue our conversation on Food Friday with WPR's Lori Skelton. We're talking about cooking Croatian style.
You can find a couple of recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you familiar with food in and around Croatia? Is it part of your family's history? Do you have a favorite dish or recipe or memory to share? Do you have questions about this kind of food and how to make it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Lori, Croatia has a long coastline and there are lots of flavorful fish that we find in the food there. Where do we start on the fish front?
You start with oily fish in the Adriatic, sardines, mackerel, something called Mediterranean sand smelt. I am dying to try. Of course, tuna bonito, anchovies. So start with fish that are oily. Simple grilled mackerel, grilled sardines would be a great way to go, especially because one of the best ways to serve grilled whole fish in Croatia is stuffing it with Swiss chard, which was new to me. I would normally put maybe branches of thyme or something, or maybe some fennel fronds. This was the first time I'd ever encountered Swiss chard, which I absolutely adore on its own. In the 80s, we all remember squid ink pasta, the black pasta that was very, very shishy for a while. Well, every seafood restaurant in Croatia has some kind of squid ink risotto, but it's not just squid ink to make the rice black. There is squid in that, but it's also chock full of other seafood, especially mussels and clams. They really love shellfish in the risotto. The other thing that I'm looking forward to trying, I made one myself, but of course, there are as many ways to make brudet, a fish stew, as there are cooks making it. I gather one of the sayings is, the uglier the fish, the tastier the stew. You'll have your fish and your crustaceans stewed down with onions, a little bit of tomato, some kind of vinegar, either straight vinegar or a lot more lemon juice than I would have expected. And then you cook it slowly until the fish is done. You'll probably throw in a little bit of paprika, maybe some bay leaves. The version I tried had this amazing combination of saffron and basil. Now, I'd always been told with basil, chop it up, you add it right at the very end, otherwise the flavor is lost. Here, the combination of basil and saffron gave this a beautiful warmth without burning your tongue.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Teresa is with us in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hi there. I have you on speakerphone. Maybe I should
That's okay. Just go for it, Teresa.
Okay. Well, all right. Yes. I grew up next to my Croatian grandmother in Milwaukee. And I had the pleasure of just being able to traipse through her flower bed to get to her house and watch her stretch strudel dough, make fine egg noodles, make sarma, make all of these wonderful dishes. And my father would make some of these things, too. He didn't stretch the strudel dough, but it was just an art just to watch her do that. Now I go to the frozen food section and get my strudel dough and think I'm doing pretty good. But he would make it from scratch, and it was just an amazing thing. And when I, in 1980, I went to visit relatives, I showed up on the doorstep, and they let me in. I had no way of contacting them in advance because of lost addresses, but they welcomed me into their home, and there I had strudel, and it was just like what my grandma made, and it was just a powerful experience, that food connection. Those many miles.
So. Thanks so much for sharing that story, Teresa.
I've got a question. You said your father was making pasta, making noodles.
My grandma was making strudel dough. Go ahead. Sorry.
Was anybody making like a noodle or a pasta or of any sort?
Yeah. strudel. Noodles. I said, they made, my grandma made strudel dough, and she also made her own egg noodle dough, and then she would roll the dough and chop in these fine little egg noodles.
I wanted to ask about the noodles. Did she ever roll them around like a pencil?
I don't remember her doing that, no.
Okay, now this is an Istrian dish that Lydia Bastianich talks about a lot, where you roll out your pasta and you cut it into little squares, and then you wrap it around something thin so that it looks like a half hollow tube, and then you serve it not with tomato sauce, but with a stew, like a chicken stew or a mushroom stew. Sounds amazing, that futsi pasta.
It sounds really hearty and incredible. Let's take another call. Nina in Royce Lake. Looks like we've got another grandmother connection. Nina, what's your story?
I am half Croatian. My father is full blood and very proud of his heritage. And we make something that is known up here as pigs in the blanket, cabbage rolls.
Yes.
But he insisted it be called sarma.
Yes, exactly. Because you either do stuffed peppers in the summer or stuffed sauerkraut in the winter. It's the same name. And yes, they love the idea of having minced meat inside a vegetable. It sounds incredible.
Yes, and no tomato sauce. That is against the rules.
Yes, exactly. That just blew my mind. I'd have a hard time getting that past my own mother.
Nina, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Lori Skelton is with us, WPR's own Lori Skelton, on this edition of Food Friday. We're talking about cooking Croatian style. We've got a couple recipes, an entree, and a dessert. You can do the dessert first if you want, like we did, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Talk some more, Lori, about pasta in Croatian cooking, going in with the stew again, not the tomato sauce.
Okay, you've got your futsi pasta, which is served with stew. We've all heard of gnocchi, the potato dumplings that are served. I've always had gnocchi with lighter sauces, very often like a pesto. Here you serve gnocchi with what is called pasticada, which is veal that is marinated in vinegar for a couple of days and then braised for hours, first in its own sauce or its own juices, and then you add more red wine. So again, the idea of pasta with something hearty on top of it. We're not going to be there at Thanksgiving time, so maybe I'll have to wait a year to try this. But they do a lot of roast turkey with what they call melinci pasta, which really isn't pasta. It's a dry, flat bread that you soak in the roasting juices of the turkey so that it sort of has the feel of like a lasagna noodle. They call it pasta, but it's technically a flatbread. And again, something very, very hearty. It goes counter to a lot of Italian cooking, but it sounds really delicious. And then, of course, there's the bean soup, sometimes served with sauerkraut, that they called menestra. Again, it's in one of Lydia's own cookbooks. She loves it. But since when did you think of sauerkraut as being part of Italian cuisine?
That has not been my experience, Lori. Let's take another call. Julie from Two Rivers, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What a wonderful show. My great grandparents were from Croatia and from just across the border in Serbia, a village called Apatin in Serbia. And then in Croatia, the village was Majevac, which I couldn't pronounce until I went there.
I am having trouble learning that language. It's a completely different sound.
It is.
It's beautiful, but it's hard.
Yes, it is. My grandmother, before she passed away, made sure I could spell and pronounce the name of the village when it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Okay.
And it was Furishmart then, and then it became Majevac. So we went there. I discovered the village. I found it, and we went there in 2014, and it was just amazing. There's a winery there that was delightful. And so now I understand, my family, they were all winemakers.
Yeah,
and my brother still is. Yep. So goulash and wine and pastries. My grandmother was an incredible cook and baker. And so, wow, it's it's really amazing. One of the things, though, the food there was the best part of the trip, Europe, the Eastern Europe.
Yep.
They are just incredible cooks. At that winery, when we approached, they had a big pot on an open fire, and I think it was goulash in there.
Great, but, Julie. Thanks so much. Are you looking forward to pairing Croatian wine with your Croatian food, Laurie?
I'm looking forward to learning more about it. I know Croatia has a great wine tradition, but it's not wine that gets to this country very often, so I'm looking forward to finding out how everything works together.
And you'll smuggle a bunch back for WPR tasting off premises, of course.
I won't smuggle it.
That's illegal too.
I do know that there are at least two wineries planned for our trip next spring, so no doubt we will have arrangements made if we want to send anything home.
I can't help but notice that certainly our callers have had comments on the food, but what they've really been talking to us about, like, memories and these connections. So when you go to Croatia, what do you hope to learn, not just about how to make the food or what it tastes like, but what it means to people?
I want to find out just how deeply those roots go. I have discovered that Franz Josef Haydn, classical music, we think of him as stuck in, you know, standard straight Vienna, that era of classical music, a lot of his symphonies, his later symphonies, were based on Croatian folk tunes. So I'm really looking forward. It sounds like a lot of this area has kind of gotten buried, and I'm just looking forward to letting Croatia stand on its own, stand very loud and proud and say, this is who we are.
Laurie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Dobro dan.
Laurie Skelton, join us for a look at Croatian cooking on this week's edition of Food Friday. She's leading a WPR travel vacation to Croatia and Slovenia, is it, Laurie?
Yes.
Slovenia, that's next May. You can find two of the recipes we've been talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got an entree, chicken and vegetables, and then we've got some cookies with black pepper in them.
They're delicious.
Sounds amazing. Coming up after the news, we'll look at some new research that's shedding light on the cost of binge drinking in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, our guest tells us why USDA research is being delayed and what it means for farmers.
First, a new study from UW-Madison is shedding light on Wisconsin's binge drinking problem.
It shows that adult binge drinking costs Wisconsin about $4 billion a year. More than half of that is the result of lost productivity.
Binge drinking is defined as drinking large quantities of alcohol in a single session. For men, that's generally defined as 5 drinks. For women, it's 4 drinks.
And the CDC says 1 in 4 people in Wisconsin binge drinks at least once a month. Nationwide, excessive alcohol causes about 88,000 deaths every year.
Julia Sherman is the coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at UW-Madison. The project was not directly involved in this research. Julia, good to have you back on Central Time.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
That $4 billion price tag in Wisconsin on binge drinking, is that a surprise to you at all?
No, but it doesn't mean I'm happy about it. We've had a binge drinking problem in Wisconsin for years. In fact, our binge drinking rates have been pretty much flat for the last 10 years. One thing is clear from this study, they're too high.
And when they compare demographic to demographic, same age group or men, women, and you compare Wisconsin to the rest of the country, we have higher binge drinking rates no matter how you slice it, it looks like.
Absolutely. Give you an example, the average binge drinking rate in the United States for people 18 and older is about 16%, and as you noted in Wisconsin, it's about 24%, close to a quarter. So we have more people drinking alcohol, and in fact, they're binge drinking about 4.1 times a month. That means basically a weekly pattern. When they drink, they're drinking 7 beverages, and that's far above the rate of binge drinking. In some cases, it's almost double. binge drinking in Wisconsin is costing us a lot of money, and it's actually beginning to affect our economic development. Look at the loss of productivity.
Right. That's the big part of the price tag, or a big part of the price tag that this report finds, losing economic productivity. How do we see that playing out? What does that mean in real life terms?
Well, you know, sometimes we don't view loss in productivity as broadly as we should. It isn't just someone who's home with a broken leg. When young people binge drink, sadly, too many of them hurt themselves seriously or even die. And that is years and years of their productive life lost. You know, Wisconsin Public Radio covered our aging workforce earlier this week. Now, what this study talks about, basically, is our younger workers, but binge drinking is actually taking them out of the job market or hurting their ability to work long term. It's absenteeism, it's losses in productivity while they're at work, and then once again, it's that premature mortality that cuts years of productive life off people.
The study from UW's Population Health Institute also digs into binge drinking rates and impact by county around the state. Are there any patterns or details that jumped out to you or that you're keeping an eye on?
Well, there's a lot to keep an eye on, and I haven't had a chance to go through every county yet. But I can tell you that the public health departments throughout Wisconsin are looking carefully at the local pattern. You see, we know what the factors are that impact binge drinking, and they're going to be looking locally at what those factors are.
And Julia, this report focuses on binge drinking, but makes the point that this is just one part of alcohol-related damage, including, you know, long-term excessive drinking, even if it doesn't day-to-day hit that binge drinking quantity. So this is just one piece of the overall puzzle.
Correct. You know, in 2013, there was a similar report that looked at the entire basket of everything that goes under the title of excessive alcohol use. That's underage drinking, that's binge drinking, and that's drinking by pregnant women. We're only looking at one aspect of that report, binge drinking, although it is, in fact, the most expensive of all three when you look at them together. It hasn't been adjusted for the economic changes, but I believe that was about $6.8 billion in 2011 for all three. But this report just looks at the binge drinking. And it's pretty expensive in its own right.
Julia Sherman is with us, coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at UW-Madison, looking at a new report from the UW Population Health Institute, looking at the costs, the financial costs specifically of binge drinking in Wisconsin, just shy of $4 billion a year. Julia, there's the problem side of things. What kind of interventions do you see as maybe helping put a dent in binge drinking in the future?
Well, we know what the four factors that basically affect people's drinking, external factors, and two of them are the availability of alcohol and the affordability of alcohol. Alcohol is very, very available in Wisconsin. As you're moving around over the weekend, sometimes it's interesting to look and see how many places you could buy alcohol as you would go from one point in your weekend to the next stop. Often you'll find it almost everywhere but the dry cleaners. The second issue is the affordability of alcohol. And as there have been many discussions, Wisconsin's alcohol taxes remain very, very low, some of the lowest in the nation.
Those are that's affordability and that's accessibility. What kind of interventions would you like to see, or what kind of interventions have people tried around the country to tackle both of those?
Well, actually, it's around the world. These are the sorts of interventions that the World Health Organization has recommended, because alcohol is a human problem all around the globe. In the United States specifically, one of the things we're looking at, and here in Wisconsin, is how we license alcohol to be sold and served. Just this week in Madison, a report was issued that's going to look carefully at how they've been citing licenses in the past and have they actually created problems by the way they've licensed alcohol in the downtown area. Communities such as Wausau and Green Bay, La Crosse, they look at their alcohol licensing policies to determine if they're creating the overconcentrations of alcohol outlets that are giving rise to binge drinking. It's a problem we can prevent in this state, and communities are looking ahead to their futures and deciding they want to.
Accessibility and affordability, and you said there were, I think, four possible interventions. What are the other two?
Well, the first one is availability, and then affordability, and then the acceptability of alcohol use and misuse. And you have to admit, alcohol is pretty acceptable in Wisconsin society. Sometimes I'm told that it's kind of hard to remain in recovery in Wisconsin because alcohol is literally everywhere. And then the final category is the attractiveness of alcohol, how alcohol is advertised. And in Wisconsin, it's sold so many places that you'll see a lot of alcohol advertising everywhere. For example, there was a study done by DHS last year that showed that 71% of the convenience stores they surveyed had alcohol advertising at 36 inches or less from the floor, a child's eye height. Alcohol advertising is everywhere. We adults have just kind of become immune to it, but our children haven't.
What could be done to raise those ads up, if nothing else, in the grocery stores?
Well, a lot of communities are now starting to look at their sign codes, tighten them up so that outside the alcohol advertising would be less prevalent. Sometimes it's simply enforcing a matter of enforcing an existing sign code. But inside, we need to be talking to our grocers and our retailers and asking them to please get the alcohol off the floor. I don't think people do it because they intend to advertise to kids, but it's an unintended consequence just the same.
Then there's the third point you mentioned, the acceptability of drinking in Wisconsin, and that seems like the most subtle thing to change. I mean, it might be hard to get particular laws and ordinances passed, but you can kind of see a path to those other three. What happens with the acceptability, especially of binge drinking in the state? How do you move the needle on that?
I think it might be easier than we realize. I think a lot of folks are sort of bullied into thinking they can't say anything about alcohol because they're told this is Wisconsin and this is the way we are, even if it isn't. I think as people try to support others in recovery, I find communities are much more open to having alcohol-free parks and recreation areas because they want to support their friends and neighbors who are in recovery that need to go to a place where alcohol use isn't there. Some people just want to go because they find it more pleasant. But areas and events in a community that are alcohol-free, they can really help support people in recovery. In addition, a lot of the community festivals in Wisconsin, you know, they're a big part of our summer here. They are adopting policies that help reduce the amount of overserving and overconsumption that occur. And these were policies that were developed in Minnesota, so we know they're going to work here in the Midwest.
I imagine you work with people from other states or go to conferences and things like that. Do we have a reputation in Wisconsin? Do they look at some of the things we do here and say, Julia, really?
Yes, they do. I was once talking about our outlet density at a conference, and someone thought I was a comedian that had been sort of inserted for humor because he couldn't believe that we really had that many outlets in Wisconsin. He assumed it was some sort of funny act. Often there's a discussion that Wisconsin is different. And in many ways, I don't want to say hopeless, but it is the way we are. We have a terrible reputation when it comes to drinking. We can laugh about it here, but it's really costing us a lot. It's not just costing money, it's costing our future. And I think we're going to see it start to affect our economic development. These productivity numbers will be noticed by economic development directors and people in HR departments across the state. This is a problem, and we're going to have to face it.
In our last few moments, Julia, do you see people taking this more seriously as a problem for the state?
Oh, absolutely. And I see it happening on the community level. They see it as a problem for the community they live in, Wisconsin. They see it as a problem in Wausau. They saw it as a problem in Green Bay. They saw it as a problem in the Village of Oregon, and they took steps. Wisconsin regulates alcohol primarily at the local level, and it is these local elected officials. They know what percentage of the calls for service to their police are alcohol-related, and they want to get that number down. So you'll see the municipal leaders stepping up and taking the actions that are evidence-based and adopted in other states and applying them here in Wisconsin. It's a matter of time. Look around. You're going to hear a discussion at your local city council or town board pretty soon on this.
Julia, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
That's Julia Sherman from the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at UW-Madison. She joined us to look at a new study from UW's Population Health Institute about the cost of binge drinking in Wisconsin. They say about $4 billion a year.
Coming up, what happens to farmers and crop markets when research reports from the USDA are delayed. We talk with a reporter covering the story coming up next on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, Ozaukee County Police have brought a decades-old murder case to a close with the help of a genealogy website. We'll find out more during our state news roundup.
First, crucial reports on USDA research into things including climate change, farm economy, and nutrition are being held up.
That's due in large part to the forced relocation of the USDA's Economic Research Service.
Politico obtained a copy of an internal document linking the expected report delays to this transition.
Food and agriculture reporter Liz Crampton has been covering this story for Politico. Liz, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the Economic Research Service of the USDA. What's important about this group? What do we need to know?
Well, the Economic Research Service, or known as ERS as shorthand, is one of USDA's core research agencies, and they do tons of different types of research in all parts of the food and agriculture industry.
And what kind of reports? Can you give us some examples?
Its researchers study everything from climate change to consolidation in the dairy industry to food nutrition programs and how their challenges that those face and how they could be improved.
So it's wide ranging. It starts with agriculture, but it really, moves into different industries.
Exactly. Their work really touches all parts of the food supply.
So what's happening that's delaying the reports that people rely on?
Last year, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, in a surprise announcement, revealed that the department was going to relocate ERS along with another research agency, the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, which funnels grants to land-grant universities. We're going to be relocated outside of D.C. to be closer to farming communities. That was the goal. That news caught the agencies by surprise. And less than a year later, the department said that they were going to move them to Kansas City. But many of the researchers didn't want to move. They didn't feel like it was necessary, and they didn't want to uproot their lives. So as a result, we've seen mass attrition from both agencies.
Is there some merit, though, to the idea that if we are researching agriculture, then we should have the people doing the research closer to the operations and not in our nation's capital?
Well, it makes more sense for the work to be done in D.C. because so much of research is done in collaboration with other D.C. agencies. And it's a myth that the researchers are in this D.C. bubble. They do a lot of field work. They get out and travel a lot. They meet with stakeholders. And of course, their communities are not that they serve are not just farmers. You know, it's consumers. It's members of Congress that they present their findings to. So it's sort of a simplified definition of what the agency's work actually does.
I'm really struck by the word that you used when writing about this. You said that the agency's work will be paralyzed because of the relocation. What's happening there? Why can you use that language?
So in the last year or so, ever since Perdue announced the relocation, two-thirds of staff ERS have left the agency. And USDA itself admitted in an internal memo that we obtained that attrition is going to paralyze much of the work. You know, from the research that's being done to the IT staff required to publish the reports online, the bodies are just not there to do the work now.
And so even if you're able to rehire at the same rate, there's still training, there's still a depth of knowledge that is lacking there?
Exactly.
What about USDA identifying these 38 specific reports? How broad sweeping are these? Are they all in one sector or do they run across the board?
it's truly across the board. You know, some of the reports are studying the most pressing issues in agriculture today, such as consolidation in the dairy industry and climate change. Of course, the USDA said that its commodity outlook reports will still be published on time, you know, such as WASDA, but those reports are going to be shorter and not as detailed as they were before. But, you know, some of the monthly commodity pricing reports that farmers rely on to make planting decisions are going to be delayed.
Yeah. Tell me more about the importance of those reports and what people use those to do.
Research in ag is so important to farmers, you know, just in determining what they're going to grow next season, but also so that they can better understand some of the biggest challenges facing this dynamic industry. And if the people aren't there to do the research and study those things, so ag is, you know, ill-equipped for the future.
We're talking with Liz Crampton, who covers food and agriculture for Politico, and we're discussing some delays in reports from the USDA that people across the sectors related to agriculture rely on. Liz, have you seen any negative impacts of these reports being delayed yet, or is it too soon to tell?
It's a little early to say, but some of the reports that were in the pipeline to be scheduled have been delayed. And it's an open question about whether they're even going to be published, whether the people that were working on those specific projects will be replaced by others who share the same interests. So the future of ERS and, you know, USDA research is really up in the air.
You mentioned that farmers can use some of this information to better understand when to plant or what to plant. How does the instability in agriculture because of these reports affect people who aren't farmers, who are outside of, you know, actually putting seed in the ground?
Look, we all depend on a stable food supply. And if farmers' work is disrupted, it's going to trickle down to when customers buy those products at grocery stores or in farmers' markets. And ERS does not just study farming issues. They also study all types of food consumption and nutrition, such as looking at challenges facing SNAP and WIC, you know, nutrition support programs that are an important part of our government support.
What do you think, when we are considering how long some of these reports might be delayed, what do you think could happen if they don't show up or they show up way too late for farmers? What happens then?
We have a huge missing hole in the information that farmers need. And without that information, the agriculture system could be compromised broadly.
And what about the staff? You said two-thirds have left. They're not relocating. They're not moving to places like Kansas City. Where do you see that going? Is USDA, you know, doing a hiring push or trying to figure out how to solve this problem?
USDA has said that they're aggressively hiring, that they're interviewing more than 100 people to replace those lost jobs. But, you know, every day that goes by without fully staffed agencies, that's more and more work that's being lost. Even if, you know, it gets up to full capacity, you know, in a couple months or a few years, we're still going to have this big black hole of research that wasn't carried out.
And that's research that applies to farmers and other groups like that. But what about the market aspect of this? How crucial are these reports that are not out right now to our commodity prices and other kinds of agriculture-related markets?
This research really is the backbone for commodity trading, and it's information that is used to inform trades that are being made. So without that information, it's a more uncertain marketplace.
Liz, what happens next? Where is your eye when covering this story?
So we learned this week that USDA's internal watchdog, the Inspector General, is investigating treatment of climate change research at USDA. And that probe includes the relocation of these two research agencies. And the Inspector General said in a letter to a member of Congress announcing that the investigation was taking place that the relocation of the agencies was in part of the investigation, in part because they wanted to find out if suppression of research was one of the reasons for the move taking place.
So we're
going to be watching for that investigation to play out, and when it concludes, what the watchdog finds out about the real motivations behind this move.
Gotcha. So it's this piece and then trying to understand the context around it.
Exactly.
Liz, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liz Crampton is a reporter covering food and agriculture for Politico. We talked to her today about the impact that delayed USDA reports could have on farmers and on crop markets. If you're looking for some last-minute pumpkin carving inspiration, look no further. Bucky Badger has some ideas for you.
UW-Madison put out an online selection of Wisconsin-themed pumpkin carving templates.
They've got the shape of Wisconsin, a Badger football helmet, not one but two W's, and of course, Bucky Badger.
Have you carved pumpkins yet this year, you and your family?
I have tiny children, and I have avoided it like the plague, but I know it's coming.
Okay.
Oh, no, it's coming.
And we're on the other end of things. For a while, we did actual pumpkin carving proper, scoop them out and carve faces. I'm not very creative, but we did what we could. And then for a while, we were just buying pumpkins. And we'll just put them out on the porch hole.
Like that?
Kind of slacker.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, you know, the squirrels. It took the squirrels longer to get in and eat them.
Yes.
But
yes, that's true.
Now, Halloween's what? How many days away? Six?
It's next Thursday.
Something like that.
Yeah.
We don't even have pumpkins yet. I've got one baking pumpkin, but I'm actually going to eat that thing. I'm not going to put it on the porch.
Rob Ferret, where's your sense of wonder and spirit?
I know, yeah, it's gone. But even when we did carve them, like a W, that would have been too creative for me. Yeah. A football helmet, no, probably not. Bucky Badger, that's beyond my talents.
When I was little, my parents resorted to saying, let's paint them to avoid the mess.
Oh,
but it was just a different
those.
Kind of mess.
It was, yeah, that's also a mess, too. And that, I don't know, the painted pumpkin seems just kind of weird. All right, let us know. Hey, send us a picture of your pumpkins. Fill us with Halloween spirit. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.